Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. With all the news about the Republican convention moving their big night to Jacksonville, Florida, in all likelihood, and with news of Donald Trump's desire to restart his rallies, including one in North Carolina, and with all this taking place before a backdrop created by COVID-19, many may have forgotten about the races in North and South Carolina for the United States Senate. So let's brush up on that today. The Palmetto State's Lindsey Graham may have an easier time of riding Donald Trump's coattails than the Tar Heel State's Tom Tillis, who faces a tough fight against his Democratic challenger. And speaking of Democrats, they are planning to engage in a fierce battle to take back the Senate and hold on to the House while fulfilling a dream to move back into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Oh, and there's also a governor's race underway here. We're going to look at all of this on this Politics Monday with three of our favorite political junkies. Dr. Michael Bitzer is chair of the Department of Political Science and Professor of Politics and History at Catawba College. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Susan Roberts is Professor of Political Science at Davidson College. Thank you for joining us from what it looks like to be your living room. Good morning.
It is. Thank you.
And Dr. Chris Cooper is Professor and Head of the Department of Political Science and Public Affairs at Western Carolina University. Thank you for coming back, too.
Yeah, great to be here.
So, Michael, how important to Democrats is the Senate race in North Carolina?
I think it is crucial if they want to regain the majority. Right now, Republicans control 53 seats, Democrats 47. Republicans, this election cycle, have almost double the seats up that Democrats do, 23 to 12. But what Democrats need is a flip of either four or five, depending on how Alabama goes. And I think North Carolina is considered by most all political analysts to be a pure toss-up. So depending on how North Carolina goes, it could control the decision of who is in the majority in the U.S. Senate come January, or potentially we could be waiting until January for the Georgia special election. So there's a lot of moving parts to this, but North Carolina is in the midst of everything.
That was going to be my next question, Susan. If either party does well here, be they Republicans or Democrats, with the Senate election, will that also determine the presidential contest, not just here in North Carolina, but also if we're going to go one way or the other, will the country go one way or the other? Are we a bellwether?
Sure. I think everyone has said that. I think we're still considered that. I will add about the Tillis race. I think it is Tillis's race to lose. And I say that because Trump has, their relationship, Tillis and Trump, has vacillated. And right now, Tillis is being very circumspect about the pandemic. He hasn't, as far as I know, he hasn't said anything about renaming of the six military bases in North Carolina. And I think it's still a bellwether state. What I'm trying to figure out is the Republican National Convention prior to the pandemic and to the troubles, many troubles with George Floyd and people putting that in context. I thought that the Republican Convention in Charlotte was going to give Tillis and everyone else a bounce. And politically and economically, I think we know what the economic fallout is. I don't think we know yet what the political fallout is for Charlotte or North Carolina, especially North Carolina.
How vulnerable, Chris, do you see Tom Tillis as being?
I think he's extremely vulnerable. I mean, I agree with everything that's been said. This is, I think the road to the majority goes through North Carolina, and there's no way to exit out before you get to the Tar Heel State. This is either side that takes the majority is going to have to do it in North Carolina. So this is critical. I think it's a tight election, and I think it is critical to both parties' fortunes moving forward.
So Tillis is in his first term in office. He squeakily won back in 2014 against the late Kay Hagan by 2 percentage points. What is his Senate record like, Chris, and how is he viewed by Republicans in particular and North Carolinians in general?
You know, I think as far as North Carolinians, I'll take the question in reverse order here. He is not particularly popular compared to other senators. As a matter of fact, there is at least one metric that shows him to be the least popular senator in the entire country. So how do you figure out if somebody is potentially going to lose re-election? Well, one, are they unpopular with their constituents? And two, are they in a purple state? And the answer to both of those questions for Tillis is certainly yes. As far as his how he's viewed in the body, I mean, he's obviously a freshman senator. He's not as well known as some other folks. He has been sometimes at odds with President Trump, other times not. So I think he is sort of a little bit difficult figure for some of the Republicans in the United States Senate to figure out.
Susan, it's one thing to be the most unpopular senator in your state. There are only two, and people know you. To be the most unpopular senator in the country, what do people in North Dakota know about Tom Tillis? Why is he unpopular?
Well, that's been one of the most difficult things for me to figure out is Tom Tillis in general. I mean, he wrote the column about agreeing with the wall, but not agreeing with Trump's use of the emergency powers to do that. And that really made Trump angry. And I think if you look at North Carolina, and also you have Senator Burr, who's under investigation for insider trading or what have you. And so North Carolina has a Senate race and a context of the Senate that doesn't look very good. And I think Tillis still is, bottom line with everything else, and I don't know, is the Kay Hagan and Tom Tillis race was the most expensive Senate race when it happened. And I would say it's going to be the most expensive one in the country. And Tillis has a pretty substantial, I think, edge over Cunningham in terms of fundraising. So I think we look at the money, and I think, you know, Tillis can ride on to be an incumbent, but to kind of go with Cooper on reaction to the coronavirus, I don't think Tillis is going to be someone that's going to jump on board the conspiracy theories about Antifa or anything like that. So I think he's going to play it safe. He's going to rely on the money, and he's not going to try to pick up a different base. And I think it's turnout. I think money, turnout, and the degree to which he, you know, Trump wasn't around when Tillis was first elected. That wasn't a phenomenon. So I'm going to see, that's a factor I want to see that plays out. The Trump factor, the money factor.
Tom Tillis is not popular in the rest of the country, if he's among the most unpopular senators in the country, how does he fare in North Carolina? Do people here, by and large, think he's okay? And if you're a Republican, would you feel more comfortable voting for Tom Tillis, no matter what his positions have been vis-a-vis the president, versus Cal Cunningham?
Well, we know that, you know, party loyalty is pretty intense in this day and age. Our hyper-polarized environment very much has the sense of, if you identify with one party over the other, you're typically going to vote for that party. Tillis is actually doing a little bit better than Richard Burr. One of the last polls that I saw had Richard Burr's approval rating down at 20%. And, you know, that speaks volumes, because Burr generally tended to have the third people approved of him, typically Republicans, third disapproved Democrats, and a third, the independents really weren't sure and didn't have an opinion until it got closer to an election. So with Tillis, it's a little bit better numbers, but they are still kind of in this range of, I would say, real danger, because you don't know how things are going to play out over the next several months. And if something monumental happens, if we have another wave, if Donald Trump's numbers continue to drop, that could be an anchor around Tom Tillis, because we know all of these U.S. Senate races have become nationalized. Yeah, we're talking about North Carolina, but we're talking about national dynamics. Mm-hmm. And the top of the ticket generally tends to drive a lot of things going down the ballot. And if Donald Trump's numbers continue to inch downward, that's a danger sign for any Republican, Tom Tillis, you know, aside.
We have two Republicans as senators from North Carolina at the moment. How often, though, Chris, do North Carolina voters decide to change parties in the Senate?
You know, I mean, we decide to do it with fairly with some regularity anyway, when you don't have an incumbent running for office, which obviously with Burr we won't in the future. So, look, I think North Carolina is the swingiest of the swing states, and I think that applies to the presidential election. I think that also applies to the U.S. Senate election. To put some numbers on Susan's point before, I think we've had the most ad spending in the country in the state of North Carolina, right? So even above, say, Susan Collins in Maine and some of these other kind of high-profile Senate races. So I think it is very possible that we will switch parties. I think this race is far, far, far too close to call.
Although a lot of money on those ads are being spent by Republicans, because back in April, Susan, two leading Democrat and Republican super PACs focused on Senate campaigns put $47 million into fall advertising, which is yet to run here in North Carolina. And the Tillis campaign dropped $510,000 on an ad buy on TV and digital platforms to run across the Raleigh and Charlotte markets after spending $750,000 on spots in recent weeks. So what does that tell you about his war chest, about his strategy, and about the kind of money that's going to be spent here?
Well, I think, and I'm going to tee up Michael in just a moment. I think political scientists have always said, do campaigns matter? And to a large extent, they do. But I think the one thing that's already been decided that Michael knows inside and out, you're not going to change the demographics between now and the election time. That's already changed since the last election. And I think when we talk about the campaigning and the money that's going to pour in, we're going to have to look at the demographics. And Michael knows that about the urban, suburban, rural kind of vote. Michael?
Yeah, I mean, Tom Tillis in his 2014 race, actually, if you take that race in the three races in 2016, he got the highest vote percentage of any Republican in central cities. Now, that was only 36%, but Donald Trump lost the central cities with only 30% of the vote. So, you know, this dynamic is really playing out, and the crucial areas are going to be the urban suburbs, the Mint Hills, the Davidsons, the Huntersville, and then what happens in the surrounding suburban counties that are such strong Republican strongholds. I mean, Tillis got 60% in places like Union County, Cabarrus, Iredale, Lincoln, but that was the lowest of the four key Republican races from 2014 and 2016. So this dynamic, money is going to count, money is going to be obscene. Tillis is already running two spots, Mike, as you noted, kind of playing up his trailer park and the diner ad, trying to make it very much a kind of, I'm one of us, I'm a North Carolinian. But at some point, he's going to be connected with the president. And all the money and demographics are going to be playing in this kind of perfect storm come November.
Well, I read this morning, I think it was in the Observer, that 85% of the population growth in North Carolina comes from people moving here from elsewhere, and most of them move to urban areas, so that the complexion of the state is changing. Is this going to be more of a, like the last election cycle? Well, we talked a lot about the exurbs as opposed to the suburbs or the farming areas, and I have 15 seconds. Michael.
Yes, to all the above. It's going to be a fascinating dynamic to see how things shift quickly in this state come 2020.
We'll come back and talk more about the North Carolina Senate race, the South Carolina Senate race, and there's a governor's race going on, believe it or not. We'll do all of that and more when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking politics on this Politics Monday, particularly the Senate races in North and South Carolina, with Michael Bitzer, Chair of the Department of Political Science at Catawba College, Susan Roberts, Professor of Political Science at Davidson College, and Chris Cooper, Head of the Department of Political Science at Western Carolina University. I want to get back to the money for just a couple of seconds. Early on, Cal Cunningham, the Democratic candidate, had raised two times the money that Tom Tillis had. The first quarter of 2020, he raised $4.4 million, while Cooper brought in about $2.1 million. But Tillis had more money in the bank in the first quarter of this year. He had about $6.5 million to Cunningham's $3 million. Does an incumbent need as much as a challenger? And a lot of money has been pouring in. Is it coming in from out of state, Chris? Two questions.
Yeah. So as far as the incumbency advantage, we political scientists for years have talked about the incumbency advantage, and the numbers vary. We tend to say, hey, maybe it's worth about $1 million when it's all said and done. Some of that is, of course, name recognition. Some of that is the ability to get free press anytime you want. So no, an incumbent does not need to raise quite as much money as a challenger does. A challenger has to get known before they can even really campaign for office. So I also think, as far as the money in general, money matters, but it's not that the most money always wins an election. There's sort of a floor that you have to hit, floor that you have to be able to raise to be competitive. And at that point, things like campaign strategy and, of course, the political times can play as much of a role, or perhaps more, than the dollars and cents.
Democrats really want to take back the Senate, and I think they would particularly want to take it back if they see Donald Trump's prospects increase in taking the White House, because that way they could at least control Congress and be a more effective check. So, Susan, will we see the National Democratic Party pumping a fortune into the key swing state races in the coming months?
I think absolutely, and I think it's going to be curious how they campaign, how a campaign is driven during the pandemic. I don't know the date. Many people are saying there's going to be a new wave, August, September. And I think that's going to be a factor. But I think no matter what kind of campaign it is, it may not be the rallies we're used to, but it is going to be television. It is going to be social media. And the Democrats will pump money into those states. And those states really are ones that the Republicans are afraid to lose. And I think the Democrats are seeing a bit of an uptick in fundraising. One thing that we've looked at as a college, and you've looked at as WFAE, and I think probably Chris and Michael have, and that is, how do you raise money during these times? How unseemly is it to go out and get money from, say, individual donors or small donors? Because small donors, these are people that might be really struggling. So I think the big money from the parties and the super PACs is going to make a big difference.
And the other question is, how do you campaign during these times? It's been a very quiet campaign. I don't know whether it would have been quiet in the absence of COVID-19, but it's certainly been hampered by COVID-19, because you can't be on the stump. So, Michael, given the fact that we have an incumbent running neck and neck with a challenger, and a Democrat at that, what does it say that we're essentially tied 5 months out?
It means we're going into the fall in the same state of political dynamics, I think. You know, campaigns usually look to Labor Day as the traditional ground game kickoff, but they're doing a lot of the prep work in the summer, identifying likely supporters, doing some early canvassing, walking the streets, getting the doors knocked, getting their name and recognition out there. And this whole dynamic of the COVID-19 pandemic, whether we're still in the first wave or we go into a second wave come the fall, I think this is going to revolutionize how campaigns are going to be operating and really change a lot of the dynamics that we normally associate based on the ground game operations. But again, it's all going to be about mobilizing and energizing. They're going to have to find new and novel ways to do it. They can't necessarily go in and knock on doors traditionally. But this is what we're going to have to look for come the fall, to see how these campaigns react to this kind of an environment.
is the fact that this race at the moment is essentially tied, and there's a lot of time between now and November, so I think it completely changed, but is the fact that it's essentially tied right now, Chris, more of a Tom Tillis problem, or is it a Donald Trump problem?
I think it's probably more of a Donald Trump problem than perhaps a COVID-19 problem. So clearly we've seen, and I know we'll talk about the governor's race later, but we've seen Roy Cooper's numbers go up as COVID-19 has happened, and we've seen Donald Trump's numbers go down. I think the conventional wisdom here is that as the as Donald Trump's numbers go up and down, Tom Tillis follows with him. So I think Trump may be leading the decline here for Tillis a little bit, and then Tillis hasn't really done anything to set himself apart. And on kind of on Michael's point before, too, on campaigning, I mean, I think the irony of all this is in the last few years, campaigns have rediscovered kind of old school campaigning, kissing babies and pressing flesh. And the problem is nobody wants their babies kissed right now and nobody wants their flesh pressed. So campaigns are having to adjust on the fly and figure out how to adjust to this new normal. And I think it's been easier for some candidates than others.
And nobody wants flies on their babies either. I just want to tell you that.
None of this.
Yeah. Talk to me, Susan, about Cal Cunningham's politics. He's the Democrat challenger. He's from Raleigh. Some people in Charlotte may not be familiar with him terribly, but talk about his politics.
Well, I think he's playing up his service record. He doesn't have the same kind of problem that I see John Ossoff being in Georgia, and that is, you know, the lack of any kind of relevance to political office. And in Georgia's whole nother story. But I think he's not, I have not seen, and maybe they're there, because sometimes you watch Netflix now, I haven't seen kind of ads that you have to see in the beginning of a campaign. And those are the bio ads. We know Tillis, he's a name, he's an incumbent, and he's doing a pretty successful job rolling out those bio ads. And I think he knows, and Cunningham should know, that this is not a time to be adversarial. And I think you're right, the money difference has shifted a little bit. The cash on hand was a huge advantage for Tom Tillis. And I really think, I'll go back, I think it's Tillis's to lose. And I don't think people are going to become that familiar with Cal Cunningham. It's going to go down to the context and really something about the consequences. And it has been, as everybody would say, it has been a cascade of events. From George Floyd and all the other pandemic related to the Confederacy issues and to, I mean, I once lived in Salisbury and they've got the Confederate monument, and they also have, if it's still there, Michael, Confederate Avenue, have they, you know, is that still a street in Salisbury?
Yep. Very much so.
And I just don't know what, I don't know what Cunningham has to do besides money right now. Except really tie Tillis to Trump and really talk about how he might be the one, talk about Tillis's record, because the vote on impeachment has evaporated. Tillis tearing that impeachment paper up, I don't know how much impeachment is going to come into that. And I, before all these things, I would have said this is a real cue for voters.
Well, that's an attempt, I think, by Republicans to paint Democrats as radical left-wing nutbags. That does not fit Cal Cunningham, it seems to me, from what I know about him. He is, as you say, a veteran. I think he served several tours in Afghanistan or someplace in the Middle East. Where does he stand between the radical left and the radical right, Michael?
I think he's a kind of classic moderate North Carolina Democrat, kind of in the mold of a Roy Cooper. Not polarizing, somebody who can try and reach across the aisle when needed, but willing to stand on certain key principles that aren't the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. And I think the Democrats are probably breathing a pretty good sigh of relief, particularly here in North Carolina, that Bernie Sanders isn't the presidential nominee, that Joe Biden is somebody who can appeal to those kind of moderate, middle-of-the-road, independents, Democrats, maybe some disaffected Republicans with Trump. You know, this dynamic, we talk about how party loyalty is driving a lot of things, but we also have to talk about this idea of negative partisanship and the fact that perhaps you're not voting for the candidate that that you support, you're voting against the guy that you don't want in office. And some of that may be trickling down the ballot as well from the presidential race down. So we're just going to have to see how this plays out in a very novel environment come November, I think.
Tom Tillis and Cal Cunningham have both agreed to do at least three debates between now and Election Day. I think Tillis wanted four, if I'm not mistaken, but they've agreed on three. And it was Tom Tillis who was pushing the idea of debating his challenger. It is usually the challenger of the incumbent who is asking for the debates. Explain that, Chris. Why the flip in the dynamics here?
You know, I think part of it may just be that he feels like he's down and he needs a little bit of a moment. He needs a chance to focus voters' attention on him and his policies. Clearly, some of it's going to be confidence, of course, and kind of how he believes that he performs on the debate stage. And my guess is a little bit of confidence because he has more experience on the national stage than Cunningham does. So kind of a gamble that he'll be the one that comes out on top. We know that debates don't make a huge difference, but they can give a small boost. And particularly in an election like this, we may not know quite as much about the candidates because of the state of the world. Perhaps it's a good move for Tillis.
Well, we know that Kennedy won the TV debates against Nixon, but Nixon won the radio debates against Kennedy because you couldn't see the picture. And Cal Cunningham is photogenic, at least from what I've seen on television and ads. Will that play in his favor if he actually debates Tom Tillis? Not that Tom Tillis is unattractive.
This,
just, this guy is younger and telegenic.
Yeah.
Sorry, no, Tom.
I think you're right. There is certainly evidence. That's kind of classic 1960 debate that was true, that, of course, Nixon was sweating, that Nixon refused to wear makeup, and that Kennedy presented well like John Kennedy. I'm not sure there's quite as stark of a contrast between Cunningham and Tillis
right.
for that to be the big difference maker. Also think candidates, frankly, are better at understanding how they're portrayed on TV. They have better handlers. So I don't think they're going to get caught by surprise the way Richard Nixon did.
Susan.
Well, I think to jump in, I think people, I've always thought political scientists have really looked and said debates function sometimes to educate the voters, and at least the first or the second. And I think, you know, I'm not going to get into physical appearance, but I think Tillis presents himself very well. He's very smooth. His ascension to politics and power in the North Carolina legislature was astounding. I'm wondering, and this is something that I know a little about, but say the debates are Zoom. I kind of expect that they will not be. I think they'll be virtual. And I think that who will this help? How will they come across? How will not just the appearance, but who can handle this sort of medium? And I just don't know. What is the Zoom presence going to do? Cunningham has run town halls. Tillis has run conference calls. Now, maybe that's the same kind of dynamic you're talking about. Who's more comfortable being on this media, and the fact that maybe Tillis is doing conference calls and Cunningham is doing more town halls.
The Hill reports, Michael, that Republicans are largely playing defense here in North Carolina. They're also playing defense in Maine and Colorado and Arizona. You mentioned the numbers a little while ago. I want to mention them again, because if Democrats take those seats, they take control of the Senate, as I understand it, and they need three or four seats to take control of the Senate, depending on who wins the White House. Is that correct?
Yes. And the other key issue I would throw into the mix is Alabama. Even with the Jeff Sessions, Tommy Tuberville, nasty Republican primary runoff that's happening, it looks like Doug Jones may not be able to pull off the miracle that he pulled off previously. So that puts the Democrats down a seat. They have to then make up amongst these 4 to 5 seats in contention.
Let's talk about Alabama for a second. I was going to do that later, but you keep bringing it up, so you want to talk about it, I can tell. The situation in Alabama is that Doug Jones, a Democrat, won a surprising election, special election, after the incumbent Republican there faced charges, some kind of scandal that I've forgotten about.
It was Roy Moore and circulating amongst malls and encouraging young women to.
So Doug Jones won that victory and took over the seat. Now, he will face either former Trump Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who is running for his old seat, which he gave up to be the Attorney General, or Auburn University football coach Tommy Tuberville. Auburn football is big in Alabama. So you have these two battling it out. One of them is going to win, and one of them is going to run against Doug Jones. Are the two Republicans so popular in Alabama that Doug Jones will be eclipsed?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it's because the two are so popular as Alabama is so Republican. I mean, this is a solid Republican state. And, you know, I think for Doug Jones, Donald Trump's going to win Alabama, period. The question is, can Doug Jones do enough to blunt that and get crossover ticket splitting voters when voters in Alabama are loyal Republican voters? I don't think many people see this as an opportunity for the Democrats to hold that seat. I think most national analysts, the Cook Political Report, Larry Sabato, others are probably seeing this as a likely or lean Republican seat, unless the primary on the Republican side gets so divisive and so ugly, and it's already there, that, you know, some of those Republicans choose not to vote for the candidate who won, but it's still a tough road for the Democrats to make.
And
up.
Sessions had been a senator for a while from Alabama, but he will probably not be supported by Donald Trump, at least not until after the primary. If he wins the primary, perhaps Trump will support him. But Trump said some very nasty things about Jeff Sessions because he wasn't his Roy Cohn as Attorney General. What role might that play with Alabamians and with that race in Alabama? I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question. You want to chime in, Chris?
Sure. Yeah, I'll be happy to hop in. So I think in the primary, I think Trump is just likely to stay out of it. But we've seen that Trump is not afraid to criticize somebody one day and then support them the next. I mean, witness Ted Cruz, witness Lindsey Graham, who I know we'll talk about later. So Trump's loyalties are not necessarily fixed. And certainly come the general election, if Sessions is the candidate, I would expect to see Trump behind him. Also agree completely with Michael, though. This really isn't about a negative reaction to Doug Jones as much as Doug Jones' election was perhaps the most unusual Senate election of the last 50 years. I mean, for a Democrat to win in South Carolina, what had to happen was that the Republican candidate had to be accused of perhaps the most horrible act a person can do. We're not going to see a repeat of that. I think the heart of Dixie will remain Republican.
Okay. Chris Cooper is professor and head of the political science department at Western Carolina University. He's here along with Susan Roberts from Davidson and Michael Bitzer from Catawba College. We'll talk about South Carolina when we come back. I'm Mike Collins. Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with on Politics Monday with Michael Bitzer, Susan Roberts, and Chris Cooper, all political scientists from various different educational establishments across the state, talking about politics this morning, particularly the Senate race in North Carolina. Let's turn our attention to South Carolina for a second, a solidly Republican state, solidly in Donald Trump's camp. Then we have South Carolina Senior Senator Lindsey Graham running for re-election, who started out as somebody who was extremely critical of then-candidate Trump and has become his water boy in the Senate, carrying everything for Donald Trump. Is there any chance, Susan Roberts, that he will not win?
I really would be surprised if Harrison won, even though he has a lot of momentum in terms of fundraising. If you look at some of the things that have happened with Trump that I think will play to South Carolina, and that is, even though Ted Cruz didn't see it, and that is, let's say, how will the photo op with Donald Trump and the Bible play in South Carolina? I don't think they may look at it as much of a photo op as some other places. I also think When you look at the pandemic response, they're going to be more aligned with Trump, given they opened pretty early. And I think you nailed it when you said Graham has to, he's national, Harrison is local. I think there'll be a lot of money poured into that race. But several of the reports I've read say that you really have to have the perfect storm, or the stars have to align for Harrison to win. I think right now they have it at 42-42. And I wouldn't take any polling right now as being indicative of how the race is going to go.
Graham won more strongly in this primary that he went through in South Carolina than he ever has. But maybe the ointment, the fly in the ointment, could be COVID-19. Because as you mentioned, Susan, South Carolina opened earlier, didn't really close down as much as North Carolina. And now, Chris, they are experiencing a serious surge in cases. Could this be, could this come around and bite people in the you know what?
I think it will bite some people with the you know what. I just don't think that Lindsey Graham will be one of those people who gets bitten. I think this is, you know, look, it is South Carolina. There's a reason we never talk about it as a purple state or a swing state in any way. And I think if you're, anytime you talk about statewide offices, you want to look at how that state performs in the presidential election. And here we see that South Carolina is bright red. For that particular seat that Lindsey Graham is in, the last time a Democrat was elected to that seat was a guy named Strom Thurmond, who ran the first time, of course, not as a Republican. And so since 1960, this has been a Republican seat.
You know, Michael, you and I are old enough to remember when flip-flopping was a dirty word in politics, and yet Lindsey Graham certainly flip-flopped when it comes to Donald Trump. He eviscerated candidate Trump in terms of what he said about him as being unfit for office and a lunatic, and I'm paraphrasing here. And then when the president won, Lindsey Graham abandoned his best friend in the Senate, John McCain, and became the biggest fan Donald Trump has in the United States Senate. How should South Carolinians view that?
I think they're going to get an excellent opportunity because there's a new ad based on a group called Republican Voters Against Trump. And what the ad starts off with is Lindsey Graham's derision of Donald Trump during the 2016 primary. And then it pivots to Lindsey Graham just speaking so highly of Joe Biden, who he has known for a very long time in the U.S. Senate. And it poses a fascinating stark contrast in terms of using that kind of an approach in terms of talking about Donald Trump, who is so well liked in South Carolina, and reminding folks of Lindsey Graham's, you know, derision towards the president early on, but then also appealing to folks about Joe Biden. And so it's going to be a fascinating study. I agree with Chris and with Susan. For a Democrat to win in South Carolina, they get up to 45%. They're not going to be able to get much more above that. And that's going to be the crucial test, as somebody like Jessica Taylor at the Cook Political Report talks about. Harrison has to attract white women, particularly college-educated women, to really get that boost to be able to be competitive and to think about winning. I'm not saying he's going to win, but he has to get above that ceiling that the typical Democrats get.
Jamie Harrison is the former chair of the Democratic Party in South Carolina. He outraised Lindsey Graham in the first 3 months of the year. He was the first black party chair in South Carolina, former aide to Jim Clyburn, who is a demagogue in South Carolina politics for a good reason. He's a former lobbyist. He's a moderate who stayed away from things like Medicare for All and tuition-free college, but he does speak about health care in vague terms and about the student loan crisis in vague terms. Now, South Carolina voters, Democratic voters, are primarily African-American. But this year, white voters surged to an estimated 50% of the electorate in the Democratic primary. Does that mean that he has enough to overcome the Republican nature of South Carolina? You're looking at me, Chris, like I've grown a horn. No.
No, not one, just two horns. Yeah. I mean, certainly, look, he's the best statewide Democratic candidate I've seen in South Carolina in quite some time. But this is still a state that has not had a statewide elected official since 2015. That was a lieutenant governor who didn't actually win elections. So this is among the most Republican of Republican states. Jamie Harrison's the best chance the Democrats have. I think these demographic shifts are important, but I think this is, it's highly unlikely. I think you would have to pair a candidate like Harrison with a very, very, very bad candidate, kind of like we saw in Alabama, to see this state.
Harrison also recently...
Yeah, and I would also say there's... Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say Trump has a double-digit lead in South Carolina. The only thing that might even make the race a lot closer, and I don't know right now, I don't recall, that is what kind of vote by mail might you have in South Carolina? Because that has tended, in Georgia even, that increased the turnout, huge turnout. And I think that that to me could be the factor, if at all, if you have more of that, that could influence and help Harrison a little bit. Trump, you know, you look at Romney and then you look at Lindsey Graham. They were the two most vicious critics of Donald Trump. I mean, vicious, not even just distancing themselves. But I think it is going to, I'll agree with Chris and with Michael, it's going to be, I don't know how much money Harrison would have to raise a lot of money and change a lot of hearts and minds about South Carolina politics. It's already there. There's a profile there.
Well, we've talked about the possible influence of COVID-19, and certainly it's influenced how campaigns are being conducted. But what about the possible influence of what we've been witnessing around the country these last 3 weeks with protests over the death of George Floyd and calls for defunding police and disbanding police departments and police departments promising change, etc.? Because Harrison has said he sees the emergence of the new South. The new South, he says, is bold, it is inclusive, and it is diverse. How might the Black Lives Matter movement and all these things that have been going on, including over the weekend in Georgia, because white people are getting, as they say, woke to this, what role might that play?
I think it could play a significant role in terms of boosting Harrison even more so. And that's mm-hmm. what he needs. He needs kind of the perfect hand to be dealt him, and he has to pull out a card somewhere to really make it even more so. But I think that this awakening, particularly over the past 3 weeks, is a different dynamic. It is a youth-driven dynamic. It is an interracial-driven dynamic. And this is really playing things to where we may not know what the potential lasting effect is going to be. But Harrison is kind of poised to do that if he can attract, say, around Charleston County, those kinds of moderates in there, the Midlands of North of South Carolina, very much the majority-minority counties, the Black Belt counties, and what happens in the upstate. It is socially conservative, but economics plays a role there as well with all of the new influx of people moving into that part of the state. So it's going to be a mix of something that I don't think those of us who study Southern politics have really seen before in the modern context, but it's going to be fascinating to watch it play out.
The state newspaper in Columbia, editorial board there, calls Jamie Harrison the strongest opponent to Senator Lindsey Graham since he was first elected to the Senate in 2002. And at one point, I think it was back in early March, an organization called Brilliant Corners Research and Strategies, whoever they are, called the Senate race in South Carolina a toss-up. And I think, Susan, you said just a moment ago it's 42-42. So is it still a toss-up? Will it be by November?
Oh, I don't think so. I think the factor that's going to be, and we look at what happened, George Floyd, and now we look at Rashawn Brooks. There's a cascade effect, really a cascade effect. And one of the base that I've seen for Biden and even for all Democrats in South Carolina has been the older Black women. And I think one of the themes that you've seen in these, the cascade of events that have looked at racism, police violence, is what do I tell my son when you go out and how do you look in terms of What do you wear? How do you respond? And I think the turnout of older Black women could make the race closer. I think it's a question more of margin than a victory, but things are happening so quickly that voters are going to look at context. It's a cumulative effect. Not one incident is going to change South Carolina. It's just cumulative.
As Democrats salivate over the possibility of taking over the Senate, I would assume that they are not at risk of losing the House. Are they? Chris?
I don't think they are in danger of losing the House. Okay. I think the House is going to remain pretty firmly in Democratic hands. And so, I think real quick, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm just going to say that Donald Trump is at least declining in polls, if you believe polls, in terms of some of the missteps that he's made with regard to COVID-19 and some of the comments that he's made and some of the action he's taken with regard to the protests, and kind of a tone-deaf response, many people would say, about some of the things he's said and done. Is that going to impact these Senate races in the states that matter to Democrats? Chris?
Yes, absolutely. I think, for example, in South Carolina, were this not a presidential year, I think we might be looking at something very different. So the fact that we are looking at presidential year for the most part, I think is going to help some of these Democratic candidates at the margins. And I think, like Michael said before, if you sort of assume that Alabama goes back to Republican, then you've really got these core four states that are going to matter. Of course, it's North Carolina, it's Maine, it's Colorado, it's Arizona. That's right. How the Senate's going to be decided on the House side. I think it's going to stay Democratic.
So three questions before we end, and we have 4 minutes, or three and a half, actually. So quick answers. According to which poll you're looking at, Biden and Trump are neck and neck in North Carolina. Tillis and Cunningham are also neck and neck. The governor's race seems to be a runaway. Cooper's up 11 or 12 points against challenger Lieutenant Governor Dan Forst. Still 5 months to go, and COVID-19 has shown made some people antsy, Susan. How difficult would it be for Forst to overcome that kind of a lead at this point?
Well, I think it's going to be difficult, but I don't think that you're looking back and his association with, say, the bathroom bill and some other very conservative responses. I don't know if that's going to be in the current memory. And I think that Cooper has shown real well. 49, I thought this was amazing. 49 out of 50 governors have approval ratings on handling the coronavirus better than Donald Trump. And so that's still going to be a response. And if we see a resurgence, that's still going to be a response. And I think Forrest, it's a long road for Forrest. Mm-hmm. You said lightning round.
That's right. The pandemic has given Roy Cooper a kind of advantage over his opponent that it gave Donald Trump, as you just said. Joe Biden seems to have found an entry point in the protests surrounding George Floyd. Dan Forrest hasn't had a similar break. Does that account for the lead that Cooper has over Forrest? Chris Cooper, no relation? Or is he just a popular governor, period?
Yeah, I think it's both of these. I think, like Susan said, you've seen Cooper rise in his approval. He's got a little bit of a halo effect going on, I think, from COVID-19. But Cooper, again, I think is fairly popular even amongst Republicans, at least for a Democrat. So about 10% of Trump voters also say that they are Roy Cooper voters. The same thing does not work on the other side. So I think Roy Cooper, of course, gets the Democrats and pulls a small but important proportion of Republicans.
Chris may have answered my question to you, Michael, but I'll ask it anyway. Roy Cooper won a narrow victory over Pat McCrory 4 years ago, and many people say that occurred because of the controversy surrounding HB2, a bill that Pat McCrory didn't pass, but he certainly supported. He paid lip service to it. But now Cooper has been described as an obstructionist by President Trump because of his refusal to allow an unfettered convention here, and they're moving the convention. That's led the GOP to look at us a little differently, I think, and they're taking hundreds of millions of dollars away from Charlotte. So will that hurt Cooper the way HB2 hurt Pat McCrory?
And certainly Republicans will use the economics of the RNC getting pulled from Charlotte. But I dare say once we get into late September, early October, it's going to revert back to the norm, to the median. And this race could be potentially as competitive as the U.S. Senate and the presidential race in North Carolina, but 15 points for Dan Forrest to make up against Roy Cooper right now is a pretty big, mountain to climb.
I know it's hard to believe, but we'll be talking about this again before November. Michael Bitzer, Chair of the Department of Politics, Political Science, Professor of Politics and History at Catawba College, Susan Roberts, Professor of Political Science at Davidson College, and Chris Cooper, Professor and Head of the Department of Political Science at Western Carolina University. Thank you all for the hour.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.